Welcome back, everyone. Ready for another deep dive?
Always.
Awesome. Today, we're going to be looking at some pretty wild imagery.
Oh.
We're talking animals, like living in peace. But, and here's the kicker, we're not just talking about, you know, like herbivores chilling together. This is predators and prey, like best buddies.
Now, that's an image. Where are we getting this from?
This is all from a lecture transcript on the book of Isaiah, chapter 11 specifically. Our expert is scholar Robert Van Noy.
Ah, Van Noy. And this is part of a larger series, right? On the major prophets.
You got it. So we're getting this section, but like with the whole context of the prophetic picture, you know.
Excellent. So let's jump in, shall we? What's Isaiah 11 all about?
So it starts off with this comparison between Assyria and the kingdom of David. Both are described as being like cut down, but Assyria is like totally wiped out while David's line survives.
Okay, got to pause you there for a sec. Just for those who might not remember, Assyria was a huge empire, right? Destroyed by 612 BC.
Right, exactly. And the kingdom of David, that's the line of kings going all the way back to, well, King David.
The one the Messiah was supposed to come from.
Exactly. So this whole idea of David's line surviving, it's super important for understanding the prophecies about the Messiah.
Okay, got it. So how does that tie into Isaiah 11?
Well, verse 1 uses this really vivid image. It's like a new branch sprouting from, get this, the stump of Jesse.
Jesse. Wait, who was Jesse again?
Oh, Jesse was King David's father.
Right, right, of course.
Yeah.
So this branch is like a symbol for the coming Messiah.
Exactly. A descendant of David who's going to bring new life and hope, that whole deal.
That's beautiful imagery.
Oh, and it gets better. Verse 2, it goes on to say that this new shoot isn't just any king. He's empowered by the Holy Spirit.
Oh, wow. Like supernaturally empowered.
Oh, yeah. It even lists out like 6 different aspects of the Spirit's power.
Let me guess. Wisdom, understanding.
Yep, those two. Yeah. Plus, counsel, might, knowledge.
And fear of the Lord. Ooh. I know my Isaiah.
Haha, nice. But see, it's not just a random list. It's telling us something about the Messiah's character, you know?
Totally. And about how he's going to carry out his mission.
Exactly. Yeah. It's all about righteousness. In fact, verse 3 describes how the Messiah will judge, but not based on appearances. He's going to judge with true righteousness.
Especially for the poor and the meek.
Exactly. It's almost like he's got this this x-ray vision into people's hearts.
Which reminds me of that verse in John 2.25, where it says Jesus knew what was in man.
Oh, nice connection.
Right. Like he sees beyond the surface, you know, into the real person.
Okay, now verse 4. This one is, well, it's a little different.
How so?
It's the only verse in this section that describes, like, the Messiah's actions. And honestly, it sounds more like a powerful ruler than a gentle teacher.
Hmm. Interesting. How is he described?
It says he strikes the earth with the rod of his mouth and slays the wicked with the breath of his lips.
Whoa. Okay, that's intense.
Right. It makes you think maybe this part of Isaiah 11 is talking about the second coming, not the first.
Could be. It's definitely got that that end times vibe, you know, like judgment and all that.
And there's this other verse, 2 Thessalonians 2.8. Paul talks about how at the Lord's coming, he'll destroy the wicked one. And guess how? Consuming with the breath of his mouth.
Whoa, that's some serious firepower. So is this about like a general destruction of all evil? Or maybe even like the defeat of a specific figure, like the Antichrist.
Oh, man. Now, those are the questions. And get this. The imagery pops up again in Revelation 2, 19.15, I think. It talks about a sword coming from the Lord's mouth to strike down the nations. Powerful stuff.
No kidding. And it makes you wonder, how literally are we supposed to take all this? Like actual mouths and swords? Or is there like a deeper symbolic meaning here?
Ooh, good question. And that leads us right into probably the most famous part of this chapter, the animals living in peace. Isaiah 11, verses 6 through 9. Here, let me set the scene for you. A wolf shall dwell with the lamb, and a leopard shall lie down with a young goat, and a calf and a lion and a fattened calf together, and a little child shall lead them. The cow and the bear shall graze, their young shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. The nursing child shall play over the hole of the cobra, and the weaned child shall put his hand on the adder's den. They shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. I mean, come on, that's pretty wild, right? Wolves and lambs chilling together.
Totally, like a scene straight out of a Disney movie, but you know, with a bit more theological weight.
Uh-huh, exactly. So naturally, this passage has sparked a lot of debate among scholars.
I can imagine. Is it meant to be taken literally? Or is it just symbolic? Maybe it's about, like, a return to that harmony we see in the Garden of Eden.
All good questions. And the lecture actually dives into three main approaches for how to interpret these verses: literal, spiritual, and figurative. A lecture seems to lean towards figurative, you know, like it's describing peace and security in the Messiah's kingdom, but without animals, like literally changing their nature.
Okay, that makes sense. But what about the literal interpretation? What are the challenges there?
Well, one big one is the whole question of death in the animal kingdom before the fall.
Right, the fall. Adam and Eve, the whole deal.
Exactly. And that event, the fall, is usually seen as what brought sin and death into the world. So if animals were already eating each other before the fall, that changes how we understand the consequences of sin.
Yeah, it makes you think, did God design the world with animals killing each other? Or was that a result of the fall? And if it was a result of the fall, then what does that mean for this passage?
Exactly. And here's where it gets even more interesting. The lecture mentions this book, God's Time Records in Ancient Sediments.
God's Time Records in Ancient Sediments. That's a mouthful.
Right. But the book argues that, well, the fossil record proves animal death existed before the fall.
That's a pretty big claim.
It is. And if that's true, it raises a lot more questions for those who take the literal view of Isaiah 11.6 to 9.
Right. Like, if animals were already dying before the fall, then what's the point of this whole peace among the animals thing?
Right. So how do we make sense of all this? Well, the lecture goes on to explore three main millennial viewpoints. We've got postmillennialism, amillennialism, and premillennialism.
Okay, so we're getting into the nitty-gritty of different theological interpretations.
We are. And these viewpoints, they each have a different take on when and how this prophecy about the animals will be fulfilled. It gets a little technical, but stick with us. These viewpoints actually ask some really thought-provoking questions about, like, our understanding of the future, you know, and our role in the present.
Okay, I'm intrigued. So break it down for me. What are the key differences between these views? And maybe even more importantly, what does each one suggest about how we should live our lives, like, right now?
Okay, so we've got these three millennial viewpoints: postmillennialism, amillennialism, and premillennialism. Each one has a different way of looking at this prophecy about the animals and how it all, you know, plays out. So where do we even begin to unpack all this?
Well, I think a good place to start is to remember that each view, they each have a different understanding of the present age, you know, like how it relates to the future. Postmillennialists, for example, they're generally pretty optimistic about the progress of the gospel in the world. Like, they believe that society is going to become more and more Christianized, and that'll eventually lead up to Christ's return.
So for them, this whole peace among the animals, it's like a symbolic representation of a future world where, like, the gospel has transformed human hearts and, you know, brought about widespread peace and righteousness.
Exactly. Think of someone like Joseph Addison Alexander. He's a prominent post-mill scholar. And he saw this transformation happening through the spread of the gospel, like right now in the present age. But it's important to remember that not all post-mill thinkers interpret Isaiah 11 the same way.
Oh, really? What are some other post-mill perspectives?
Well, the lecture mentions Franz Delitzsch. He was another influential post-mill theologian, and he actually pushed back against those who saw the animal imagery as purely symbolic.
Oh, interesting. So what did Delitzsch believe?
He believed that the prophecy pointed to a real transformation, like a physical transformation of creation, a kind of renewal of paradise. He saw it as part of God's plan to redeem not just humanity, but like the whole created order.
So he's saying that the peace described in Isaiah 11 isn't just about, like, changes in human hearts. It's also about a tangible change in the natural world itself.
That's how we understood it. And what's even more interesting is that Delitzsch believed that this transformation would happen, like, within history, not just in some far-off eternal state. He saw it as a gradual process, unfolding as the gospel spreads and, you know, its influence permeates every sphere of life.
Wow, that's a pretty radical idea. To think that the world we see around us with all its brokenness and violence could one day be restored to a state of peace and harmony, like the Garden of Eden.
It definitely stretches our imaginations, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And it raises all sorts of questions, like what would that kind of transformation look like in practice? Would predators, like, lose their natural instincts? Would the food chain be completely reordered? These are questions that even theologians who share a post-mill perspective, they continue to debate.
Okay, so we've got post-millennialism, with its focus on the gradual spread of the gospel and how that transforms the world. Now, what about amillennialism? How does that view fit into all of this?
Amillennialists, they have a different understanding of the timeline. They don't see a literal 1,000-year reign of Christ on earth before the final judgment. Instead, they view the present church age as the millennium, a time when Christ reigns spiritually in the hearts of his people.
So for them, the peace described in Isaiah 11, maybe it's more about the spiritual reality of peace with God that, you know, believers experience now through Christ.
Exactly. Think of a scholar like E.J. Young. He was a well-known amillennialist, and he saw the prophecy as partially fulfilled now, you know, in the sense that we experience glimpses of peace and righteousness through the work of the Holy Spirit. However, he believed the ultimate fulfillment of Isaiah's vision would only come in the new heavens and new earth after Christ returns.
So while amillennialists might work for peace and justice in the world, they wouldn't necessarily expect to see, like, a complete transformation of society or the natural world before Christ's second coming.
Right. For them, the focus is on the spiritual reality of the kingdom of God that's, you know, already present but not yet fully realized. They see the ultimate hope for true peace and harmony, not in this current age, but in the eternal state where God's will is perfectly done.
Okay, that makes sense. So we've covered postmillennialism and amillennialism. Now, what about the view we hear most often in popular Christian culture? Premillennialism. Where does that fit into all of this?
Premillennialists, as you might guess, they believe in a literal thousand-year reign of Christ on earth before the final judgment. They often point to passages like Revelation 20, which, you know, describes this period in detail. Now, within premillennialism, there are different views on the timing of the rapture, like when believers will be caught up to meet Christ in the air. But they all agree on a literal future kingdom ruled by Jesus here on earth.
So how do premillennialists understand the prophecy in Isaiah 11, the one about the animals living in peace? Would they see that happening during the millennial reign of Christ?
Well, like with the other millennial views, there's a diversity of thought even within premillennialism. Some, like J. Barton Payne, who we mentioned earlier, they take a more nuanced approach. They believe the peaceful conditions described in Isaiah 11 might be localized, perhaps only applying to a specific area around Jerusalem, like Mount Zion, during Christ's millennial reign.
So picture this, lions and lambs cuddling up on the Temple Mount while, like, the rest of the world continues with business as usual. That's a pretty interesting image.
It is. And it highlights the different ways that premillennialists try to reconcile the, you know, the literal language of Isaiah 11 with their understanding of the millennial kingdom. Some see it as a global transformation, while others, like Payne, suggest a more limited scope for the prophecy's fulfillment.
So it seems like there's still a bit of mystery surrounding how this prophecy will ultimately play out, even within specific millennial views.
Absolutely. And that's part of what makes this study so fascinating. It invites us to wrestle with the text, explore different perspectives, and ultimately trust in God's plan for the future, even if we don't have all the answers right now.
Well, speaking of the future, we haven't even touched on Isaiah 11:10 yet. This verse talks about the root of Jesse, another reference to the Messiah, standing as a banner for the nations. It says that the nations will rally to him, seeking his guidance and finding rest.
That's right. And it ends with this intriguing phrase, his rest shall be glorious.
Now, I remember the lecture mentioned some interesting interpretations of that phrase. One interpretation really stood out to me because it seemed a bit strange.
You're probably thinking of how the Latin Vulgate, you know, that ancient Latin translation of the Bible, they actually translated rest as sepulchre.
Yes, that's the one. So they thought this whole passage about peace and the Messiah was just like, about a fancy tomb. That seems like a bit of a stretch.
It does, doesn't it? Thankfully, most scholars agree that it's pointing to something much bigger. The lecture connected this rest back to Jesus' words in Matthew 11:28. You know, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest.
Ah, now that makes a lot more sense. So Isaiah is saying that the Messiah will be a source of rest for all the nations, not just the Jewish people. That's a pretty radical idea for that time period.
It is. It's a beautiful picture of the hope and healing that the Messiah offers to a world burdened by sin and strife. And it's a rest that goes beyond just like physical peace or political stability. It's a deep spiritual rest that comes from being reconciled to God through Christ.
And it's a rest that will be glorious. But what does that glory entail? Is it just about like outward peace and prosperity? Or is there something more, something deeper that Isaiah is hinting at?
That's a great question. And honestly, it's one that we can only speculate about. But I think it's safe to say that the glory of the Messiah's rest will far surpass anything we can imagine.
You know, we've been so focused on Isaiah 11.69 and its implications for the future that we haven't really talked about what it means for us today. Does this passage have any, like, practical relevance for our lives right now, even if the complete fulfillment is still to come?
That's a really important point. It's easy to get caught up in debates about the millennium and lose sight of how this passage can speak to our lives, you know, like in the here and now.
So how do we bridge that gap? How can we apply this vision of peace and harmony to, like, the very real conflicts and divisions we face in our own world?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Yeah.
And while there's no easy answer, I think Isaiah 11 offers some valuable insights.
Mm-hmm.
For example, notice how the peace described in this passage, it's not just about the absence of, like, violence or conflict.
Right. It's about something much deeper than that.
Exactly. It's about a fundamental transformation of relationships. It's about predators becoming herbivores, natural enemies dwelling together in harmony. It's a radical reordering of the way things are, a complete shift in perspective.
So it's not just about, like, ending wars or stopping violence. It's about something more fundamental, more, I don't know, more heart level.
I think so. It's about cultivating a spirit of peace and reconciliation within ourselves, within our communities, and even within our relationship with the natural world.
That makes me think of, like, Jesus's teachings about peacemaking, about loving our enemies, about turning the other cheek. Those are some radical ideas, and they definitely go against our natural inclination.
They certainly do. But I think Isaiah 11, with its, you know, kind of crazy vision of wolves dwelling with lambs and lions eating straw, it reminds us that the Messiah's kingdom is one where old enmities are broken down, where seemingly impossible reconciliations become reality.
It's a kingdom where peace isn't just like an abstract concept. It's a lived experience, a way of relating to others that goes against, you know, our natural instincts.
And it's a kingdom that starts not in some distant future, but in our hearts, like right now.
That's a powerful thought. What if the peace Isaiah describes isn't just a future reality, but like a present possibility?
I think you're onto something there. What if the lion lying down with the lamb isn't just a metaphor for some far-off utopia, but like an invitation? An invitation to embody that spirit of peace and reconciliation in our interactions with others, even those we consider our, you know, quote-unquote enemies.
That's a profound question, and one that I think deserves further exploration. You know, it's amazing to think about this vision of peace and reconciliation in Isaiah 11. It's not just some, like, abstract concept. It's rooted in the person of the Messiah, you know, the one who embodies those qualities.
For sure. And that takes us right back to Isaiah 11.10. where it talks about the root of Jesse, which is another name for the Messiah, standing as a banner for the nations.
Yeah.
Basically, it's saying that people from all over the world will be drawn to him, seeking his guidance and finding rest in him.
Like, he becomes this beacon of hope, a rallying point for a world that's, like, searching for peace and meaning. The lecture mentioned this connection between that verse and Isaiah 2.3. Do you remember what that was about?
Yeah, Isaiah 2.3 describes people from all nations streaming to Mount Zion. You know, the mountain of the Lord in Jerusalem. They say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways so that we may walk in his paths.
Ah, so both passages are talking about how the Messiah has this global appeal, this ability to draw people from all over the place, all walks of life, to himself.
Exactly. It's a beautiful picture of how the Messiah appeals to everyone. He transcends cultural and national boundaries and unites people from all over the world. And it all ties back to that idea of rest that we were talking about earlier. The Messiah offers this kind of spiritual homecoming, a place of peace and belonging for all who seek him.
It's powerful stuff. And it makes me wonder, what does it look like for us to embody that welcoming spirit, like, in our own lives? How can we be a source of rest and refuge for those around us, regardless of their background or beliefs?
That's a great question. You know, it's so easy to get caught up in our own little bubbles, our own tribes, and forget that the Messiah's message is all about radical inclusivity.
It's a challenge, that's for sure. But I think Isaiah 11, with its, you know, crazy vision of wolves and lambs chilling together and lions eating straw, it reminds us that the Messiah's kingdom is one where old enemies are done and seemingly impossible reconciliations become reality.
It's a kingdom where peace isn't just some abstract idea. It's a lived experience. It's a way of relating to others that goes against our natural instincts.
And it's a kingdom that begins not in some far-off future, but in our hearts right now. So as we wrap up our deep dive into Isaiah 11, I think the big takeaway for me is this. The peace and harmony that we all long for, both in the world and in our own lives, it's not something we just sit around and wait for. It's something we actively participate in creating.
Now that's a powerful insight. It's about embodying the spirit of the Messiah, embracing that radical message of love and forgiveness, and working towards reconciliation in all our relationships, even when it's tough.
It's about recognizing that even in the middle of all the chaos and division in our world, the seeds of peace and hope are already being planted, and it's up to us to nurture those seeds, to let them grow into something amazing.
So, as we leave you to think about this incredible chapter, we want you to consider, what does it look like for you to be a peacemaker in your own life, in your own little corner of the world? How can you live out the spirit of Isaiah 11 and help create a world that's a little more just, a little more harmonious? These are questions worth thinking about, questions that could change not just your own life, but the lives of those around you.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into Isaiah 11. Until next time, keep exploring, keep asking those tough questions, and keep searching for truth.